Welcome to the Offshore Wind Podcast, hosted by Stuart Mullen and David Lenti. Offshore wind is one of the world's fastest growing energy sources, with strong year-on-year growth expected across the next few decades. Many nations are banking on offshore wind to play a major role in reaching their net zero and sustainability targets and helping their economies recover from the COVID-19 crisis. On the technology front, turbines are bigger and more powerful than ever. Offshore wind farm capacity factors continue to rise, and we're seeing a surge of interest from oil and gas giants seeking to transition their businesses away from fossil fuels, as well as increased competition from the developers who have championed offshore wind from day one. New markets in Asia, the Americas, and eventually Africa, accelerated growth in Europe, the rise of floating offshore wind, and increasing interest in power-to-X and green hydrogen solutions are creating the basis for offshore wind to power the global energy transition. The Offshore Wind Podcast series looks at the issues facing the offshore wind industry today and tomorrow.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Offshore Wind Podcast. My name's Stuart Mullen. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Global Wind Energy Council, and I'm here at the desk, as always, by Mr. David Lenti from Siemens Gamesa. David, welcome to the desk once again, and I believe you have a new title today. You're now the Corporate Operations and Governance Community Lead at Siemens Gamesa.
It's communications lead.
Communications Stuart. Lead.
Nonetheless, all fine. That is correct. Yes. And may I praise you again today on the glorious decoration of Mullen Road Studios here on this very, very nice warm spring day in Denmark.
Yeah. My wife's telling me to get the Christmas lights down, but there'll be Christmas again soon enough.
Right,
anyway.
Right on the corner.
Yeah, so today we have a very special guest. We have your CEO, David. We have Mr. Jochen Eichholt, the CEO of Siemens Gamesa Renewable Energy. Welcome to the Offshore Wind Podcast, Jochen.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Look, as we start out each podcast when we have a guest on the show, we try to delve a little bit into the background of who's, you know, the person behind the persona. I think that, you're a very well-known person within the industry, but maybe people don't know who you are as such, you know, how you got to where you are in life. So maybe if you could just spend a couple of minutes just walking us through your background, how you came up in the Siemens world and what you've been doing prior to being CEO of Siemens Gamesa.
Well, happy to be here. As I said, the situation was that I joined Siemens rather late. I was almost 40 years old. But after that, was in a variety of different businesses, in the communications business. I became sold to a company called BenQ when I was part of the cell phone business of Siemens. But later on, I joined Siemens again. And for the time after 2008, I was able to contribute a little bit to the success of the then called mobility business. And I had the pleasure to run until the end of 2017. That was the time when this merger with Alstom was announced.
Okay.
Now, a couple of steps after that, but still since 2020, I joined the energy world. I was part of the board, of the executive board of Siemens Energy. And in the beginning of 22, I was asked to take over the responsibility for Siemens Gamesa, which I happily did. I've never been working in an environment where the perspectives of the business space as such are so tremendous like they are today here in wind.
Yeah, so just to walk back a little bit, so the Siemens mobility stuff, that's all the trains, the Siemens trains, etc. That was that area, yeah? That's a pretty...
Absolutely.
So
well, it was also infrastructure, so that is more software business. But in the end, it's been also the trains, and we had a lot of large projects across Europe, actually. Yeah. Actually across the globe, but also across Europe.
Yeah.
And for instance, in the UK, the Thames Link project was one of the bigger ones for me.
Wow. So these are big energy using projects. So now you're in the energy generation business. You used to use the energy, now you're making it. I guess this gives you a fairly well-rounded view of the whole energy cycle.
Well, certainly that's one aspect to it. The other thing is, in the end, we have to deal with a couple of mechanical elements in our business. We have to then kind of get it integrated with some energy generation or consumption, but a generator is not that different from a motor.
Yep.
So in the end, The businesses are not that different, since all the businesses are really product businesses.
Yeah, when you get the CEO of Siemens Gamesa on a podcast, you have about a million questions. But because this is the offshore wind podcast, we'll try to contain it to the offshore wind business. And I think that because, you know, as an industry in general, I think the whole industry is looking at, you know, how do we solve the supply chain challenges? How do we get more permitting into projects? How do we, you know, as a region, structure up? But I think, you know, today we need to focus our time and our questions into the offshore wind business. But I know that you've recently been at Ust-Enna for the, I guess it was the North Seas Summit, I think it was, down there. And, I think that I'm presuming that all of Europe is looking to Siemens Gamesa as to what to do with the offshore wind space for this market. Can you shed a few thoughts around around how you see the industry, maybe at the current state of the industry and some of the markets therein?
Well, I think the overall business volume is becoming more and more recognizable or seeable, not so much in theoretical terms, but also in practical terms. In Ostende, we now had the situation that nine countries with the head of the governments and the economic representatives, the ministers, being present and underlining that it's their own joint target to develop wind as one of the stronger pillars of the energy system of the future. So that as such was unique. We had seen before last fall a meeting where four countries came together. That was the North Sea Summit,
yep.
If you wish, in the port of Esbjerg in South Denmark, and now in Ostende, that round has been enlarged, and that's as such absolutely great. The other thing is they kind of almost doubled the targets for the various aspects of wind and also for offshore. The question is now, is that now easy to achieve those targets or not? And frankly speaking, the second half of the meeting was dedicated to defining impediments of what is kind of potentially not functioning and how can that work. In this context, however, I believe that there's still a lot of homework to be done because those things we already mentioned in the first time, like the issues on permitting or the issues on building up the grid or the issues around the auction designs, if auctions are the mechanism to award developers with something. So those things have not been really addressed. And that is still on the homework list, if you wish, the to-do list, in this case, not by us, but by governments mostly.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating also to hear about how Europe's, now I guess that we're starting to see offshore wind spread around the world. You know, US is starting to pick up. I guess we're starting to install more turbines out there. Taiwan, we've got some steel in the water, so to speak, and there are other markets around the world that are the APAC area is starting to ramp up as well. So it's interesting to see how Europe's reacting to some of these global challenges and seeing how the rest of the world is developing and responding. I mean, I got the feeling that the IRA has been a big motivator for companies like Siemens Gamesa that actually provides a fairly clear pathway for your investment and what that means to invest. Is that right?
Well, in a way, yes. Going forward, if we discuss the US business, we typically think of a business which is more or less completely localized, certainly when it comes to the manufacture of blades and also nacelles, so the final assembly, if you wish. And that localization obviously will require resources and investments, and those are supported. And beyond the pure IRA agreement, there are also incentives and possibilities to get support on the, for instance, East Coast of the United States. And this is what it makes attractive to what makes really attractive to be there. And also we, as one of the players here, think that we can develop a good market share in the US.
When we're talking about market share and products, you've mentioned nacelles, you also mentioned blades just now, Jochen. I'm also curious about some of the other developments aside from, you know, just a regular typical Stuart mentioned steel in the water, but sustainability and how we integrate that into our products. Mm-hmm. And I know that we at Siemens Gamesa at the Wind Europe conference and trade fair a couple of weeks back in Copenhagen announced the Greener Towers project. Can you tell us a little bit about that? The product, I should say, also has been a couple in a little order also.
I think our product typically by nature is rather green. And when it comes to recyclability, we've been in a leading position, for instance, with the blades, because we offer solutions now where the blades, mostly around the epoxy resin, can be recycled rather elegantly. Now, the latest step towards a greener world and the use of greener components, indeed, was the so-called greener tower. This greener tower is typically a thing where you have, a tower which sometimes weighs more than 2 tons, and out of that, typically the vast majority is steel. And if you could now make use of steel, which is produced with the help of less CO2 emissions, then this would be attractive. So what happened is we've elaborated on a supply chain which makes use of scrap metal more. We then have for the melting of the steel, different type of furnace being used. That's an electric arc furnace. And then there's also, for instance, the possibility to use more renewable energy as such. So there's a couple of things here, which if they come together, take us to a world where the steel which is being used is produced by up to 63% less CO2. And that's millions of tons per tower. So this is why it's so relevant.
That's absolutely fascinating.
Just to dive in a little bit deeper here. It seems that like Siemens Gamesa, you've got a huge amount of like activity that you guys have taken on your own responsibility, and you're developing all of these great solutions. Is the industry actually prepared to pay for these? Like, can you actually do you get a premium does that hard work and all of that R&D and all of the stuff that it takes you, does that get recognized from the developer side, or is this just part of like, yeah, okay, we've got to get our scope 2 emissions out of the, down, and then everyone has to pull their part? Because this costs money. Who pays for this in the end?
Well, in the end of the day, there is a yes and no. So no clear answer to that.
Okay.
The components typically are slightly more expensive. Is the full R&D effort in the end of the day compensated for? In my view, rather no.
Yep.
But the relevance of these components will be increasing, and you have an increasing number of customers who are interested. And after the publication of these concepts, for instance, on the Greener Tower, there's been other customers than the chosen ones approaching me directly and say, look, we want to do this as well. I mean, you just need to tell me. So I believe earlier or later, it's perhaps becoming a little bit more of the standard in our industry. So going forward in a couple of years, I would assume these things become more like an hygiene factor of what's being offered. Right now, it's an extra. It costs extra money, and some customers are prepared to pay for it, others not.
I guess that's pretty much like the whole offshore wind value chain. When we're trying to introduce floating offshore wind, we know that that's the introduction of that's going to cost a little bit more to start with, and then over time when we get the scale built out, then we can perhaps see this, the price has come down again. But I don't know, so just sometimes I think that the industry, We do all of these, we have all of these expectations that we will continue to invest in R&D, and yet we don't necessarily always provide the baseline funding for us to be able to do that. But I guess you guys know that much better than I do, and you probably can't say that much because all of your customers are listening going, oh, okay, this is what they think.
Yeah. No, I think indeed the economic situation of our industry space is not the easiest one. And that is then specifically relevant when we're discussing large figures of growth, because in the end of the day, perhaps the extension of capacities can be seen as something which easily can use up money, substantial money. An additional plant can easily go beyond 500 million euros, and therefore it's relevant.
Yeah, I've got a follow-up question there, but I know, David, you want to round out the last point.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, so Jochen, if we're talking about 500 million euro per factory, and the three biggest OEMs in the sphere now, so Siemens Gamesa, GE, Vestas, are all publicly struggling financially. How do you see governments supporting all of us? So the benefits, especially certainly from a Siemens Gamesa perspective, in getting the funding towards building out this capacity to meet the targets, which are their individual national goals.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of discussions ongoing. There's a couple of considerations on how to support factories and other activities. We typically distinguish between innovation-related activities, like we develop something new or a different technology, and capacity-related activities, like we would like to enhance our capacities and perhaps with this also generate additional employment. Yeah, and these things are being looked at, and there is some movement, but not enough. Clearly, I mean, if we consider, for instance, opening a new plant, then there is a massive need for additional support. Otherwise, it won't be possible, and that is what's currently being in discussions and in articulation by us in those countries where we're doing this.
Yeah, so anyone that listens to the Offshore Wind podcast regularly knows that they can't go an Offshore Wind podcast without me mentioning Australia. And I think Australia is one of those interesting markets where I think the traditional OEMs have a strong presence in the onshore space, and there's a lot of our hydrogen and onshore wind and hydrogen, etc. Now we're getting into the offshore wind space, and we had a Victorian delegation at Wind Europe recently, and we've had the Australian Energy Minister in Europe, and we've had the Victorian Energy Minister in Europe. And so this is a country that has, I think, the initial project is for 2 gigawatts, and yet we've got people trying to work out how can we attract the supply chain, and what do we need to do to attract the supply chain? And for me, we try to, I guess, explain to the stakeholders in the market that we have to be realistic, and we have to start to look at the supply chain maybe on a regional basis, and we also have to look at the consequences of having, no one wants stranded assets anywhere. But I was just wondering, like for a market like Australia, how do you actually have these conversations with the politicians in a market to kind of, maybe get them to increase their volume to a point where they can actually have a supply chain, or maybe temper their expectations completely, saying, okay, look, in this market, in those years, it's going to be really difficult for you to get capacity?
No, it's a neat and not fully solved question. And specifically, Australia for me is a market which I find attractive in those various dimensions you mentioned. But clearly the ramp up for me, for Australia as such, is not a solved question by now. And since it does require substantial innovation still, but also substantial investment beyond that, in my view, it will be difficult for all the classical players to actually go for those investments without any further support.
What country? So a lot of the stuff, if we all talk about, difficulties in industry and so on a positive note, though, changing gears a little bit, where are some of the countries that you see really excellent developments and growth opportunities that are more real than imagined?
Hey, don't say that. More real
than
imagined.
I'm not nothing bad about this.
What are you talking about?
You know, so I'm a fan.
Brazil,
man.
Australia, all of the people.
I'm with you all the way, Stuart.
We know that the Canadian Energy Minister also listens to the podcast, so we have to be careful who we say.
Everybody likes the Australians. Yeah. Everybody likes the Canadians. Fully agree.
No, sorry. Thanks. Anyway, the more real
Let's
markets.
Let's go back to Jochen Eichholt instead of you, Stuart Mullen. Jochen, please. Some other areas where you see growth markets.
I think I see positive developments all over the place. I think the principal starting point of all that is that I think many really many have identified wind as one of the stronger pillars of the energy system for the future. So depending a little bit on the country, you sometimes have different concepts. So sometimes it wants to be complemented with solar and sometimes with batteries. But in the end of the day, every bigger concept for energy systems of the future does contain wind. So therefore, we see strong growth in many regions. Some regions are more mature than others. For me, for instance, Northern Europe continues to be strong and will be strong in both onshore and offshore. We've talked about Australia, but we also see places like the US, where, in my view, the offshore development hasn't even really started yet. Yeah. Onshore is kind of coming up again quickly after the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. We then see places like India, where I think they're also there's a huge amount of need or a huge need for wind energy, and that so far is still to be elaborated how that works. We of course see the biggest wind nation on earth, that is China. So sometimes the demand of China alone is more than 50% of the global installations.
Yeah.
So it's happening all over the place. And this, I believe, is the good news. And we now need to make it happen in the most elegant way.
You guys published a white paper, scaling up the American wind industry. I guess that's kind of a signal that you really believe that the US is going to be, you know, that we're actually going to see all of those volumes that's been awarded, built out in the timeframe that they announced that they're going to be built out.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we sometimes do observe that specifically in the US, people shoot fast. So therefore, we sometimes need to make sure that we also hit the target. I think it's more than attractive what's published so far. But please remember, the IRA as such is not defined yet to the necessary extent. So nobody can calculate right now to us what something on a project-specific basis really means. So therefore, we need to have a clarification of rules. We need to make sure that for longer lasting projects, we have what we call inflation compensation. Also in the US, you see inflation. We need to make sure that the workforce generation is happening. Specifically in the US, we sometimes fight for instance, service technicians in the industry. So that needs to be covered. And then in the end of the day also, and I think this is also widely known, if you have wind farms and wind turbines installed somewhere, then you still need to kind of get the energy from A to B. In other words, the grid needs to be extended, and the grid in the US is oftentimes seen as not the strongest pillar of the system.
In relation to one of the things that we always get asked at the Global Wind Energy Council is, you know, how big can these offshore wind turbines get? You know, when's the next generation coming? And when I started at Siemens, when it was Siemens Wind Power back in the day, I think it was a 2.3 megawatt machine being installed offshore, and then we went to the 3.6, and then the 6, and then like the 8, and now we're 16, and now, you know, and people want a 20 megawatt. I mean, and if I look at the bigger challenges, I don't think that we've actually, while the OEMs have done a great job in building the boilerplate capacity of the turbines, I don't think that's necessarily resulted in more unit sales around the globe. I think that the unit sales have been pretty constant. So unless we get a whole lot more unit sales, I mean, how do we start to build up these bigger machines? And then again, you know, like, and if we keep building bigger and bigger and bigger, then it means that the vessels that we had, you know, currently are now no longer fit for purpose. So I think that there's a, you know, do we need to reach a plateau and just agree that, okay, that this is going to be the biggest turbine that we get, and these are going to be the dimensions and specifications, or is it competition always going to drive bigger and better?
Well, there's always an element to that. But I believe the drivers behind that development also need to be looked at. And typically, there's an economic aspect behind that. So, of course, one could build things which are getting bigger, but then suddenly the related efforts, also the qualification efforts, maybe developing exponentially rather than linearly. So that is, I think, a kind of natural limit. And, well, frankly speaking, by even per today, I think the biggest turbines which are installed are in the range of 15 megawatts, are kind of big in my view. So yeah. you have a platform where you stand on a level of 170 meters above the sea level or above the ground level. You then have blades which are kind of more than 100 meter long. Already that I find rather, I have to say, big. I mean, just having stood on one of those things,
yeah.
I believe these machines make you humble as a person.
Sure.
And then thinking about those things becoming perhaps 20 or 30% bigger, we have to be extremely careful on where to propose this and why and under which circumstances, because economic reasoning may require also to go more for higher availability figures or more, let's say, a combination of cost out and then industrialization of the products. And please remember that even if a wind farm may, let's say, contain 100 or so turbines, this is not really volume production in the sense of other industries.
Yep.
So one could imagine that there's further cost out to come and the numbers of turbines want to go up. But reliability and availability and less technical risks may also be of relevance in this discussion. So we haven't really made up our minds. I wouldn't exclude bigger machines for the future. Right now, I would advise us to be a little careful about the technical risk behind those.
I think one thing that also goes hand in hand, and as Stuart always mentions, Australia, one thing I always like to try and mention is safety. It's a personal... personal issue for me. I find it very, very critical, and will always ensure that people understand the importance of it. Do you see safety performance improving, staying the same, worsening across the industry?
I view it as kind of stable at a level which I don't find good enough. If we look at more classical industries like the oil and gas industries, we also sometimes have, you know, offshore platforms. There, the level of incidence is typically lower. We put an awful lot of effort internally in the Minister on health and safety. It's really at the core of our activities. It's really the first topic on the meeting agenda. We look at numbers and phenomena on a very regular basis. We see a positive trend towards a reduction in severity of the issues. Still, there are still, in my view, too many findings or incidents, oftentimes not necessary, oftentimes one would say not needed, but the overall number of incidents, in my view, is still too high.
Yeah. So I think we are starting to reach the top of the hour and our time together. And when we get to this stage of the podcast, Jochen, we like to ask our guests each week what they have. Has there been anything that's caught their attention of recent times that they would like to share with the listeners? And I was wondering, you know, as CEO of Siemens Gamesa, what's been occupying your thoughts of recent times?
Well, I mean, it's of course been things like Copenhagen or the Ostende meeting last week, or the follow-up meeting on where some fewer European member states meet in Berlin in some different configurations. So it's this kind of ongoing discussion on how to speed up and how to substantiate the development of wind as a pillar for the energy system. And what's relevant for me in this context is that, for instance, in China, wind is looked at from a strategic perspective. Strategic means this thing is mid to long term, very relevant for all of us, and this is why many things have to be aligned. If we look at Europe, I think it was established now that wind is supposed to become one of the pillars of the energy for the future for various reasons. One is the thing which is called energy sovereignty or independence, specifically after the Ukraine war. I think many people know what that is. At the same time, we want to become green. That was also before the war, and it continues to be the case after the war. So we need to be as green as possible. Less CO2 is the key word. What sometimes tends to be forgotten is we want to have affordable energy. We don't want energy to be a luxury good. We also would like to make sure that the baker shop around the corner still can exist. and that he does require energy, so it must be affordable. We would like to make sure that we are, in my view, independent as Europeans, also in a way that we have the know-how base and the capacity base for manufacturing of those elements, perhaps not everything to 100%, but it needs to be there. Please remember that, for instance, behind the capacity factor, we also have the questions around employment. And we right now employ in Europe around 300,000 individuals. Of course, they are taxpayers, but of course, we also need to have that know-how base for the capacities, and that going forward is to increase. So I think with this, we sometimes need to be mindful about how we auction wind farms, if auction is the mechanism to give access to developers to some wind farm or seabed. It needs to be looked at from a perspective that we need to protect this know-how and need to make sure that we stay independent. I'm not a friend of so-called decoupling discussions where specific areas of the world can be kind of decoupled from, but I think we need to be very mindful about dependencies, specifically when it comes to specific elements of what we are looking at, like rare earths or like, for instance, fibers, glass fibers. So we need to be mindful about how to handle that and need to translate that into a, I would say wind or wind industry specific strategy at European level, which so far is not really there. Please remember that specifically in Europe, we have typically the protection of competition, very important element also of the European, very specific sector in of the European Commission. But for industry development, I think we so far still do not see something which is at equal level. And that is, I believe, the biggest thing which I would be advocating for, that we actually do have an industry policy which across the nations makes these things happen. It's looking at, speeding up all these things which are sometimes discussed.
Yeah.
We right now have some 80 gigawatts of wind in the permitting process. So somewhere in the permitting process, so typically these permitting processes end positively. So you could argue that, 80 gigawatts sit somewhere, and if just the process would be speeded up, then most of that would really come to projects. So that so far does not happen. And these permitting processes sometimes take up to 7 years when we're discussing offshore. So these things need to be looked at, in my view, in order to make all of us become beneficiaries of this part of the energy system going forward, which we all strive for.
Wow. Thank you very much for that. That was, again, that's actually a whole intro to another podcast. I think we could dive down into each of those issues. But, I mean, that's a ridiculous amount of gigawatts to be stuck in permitting, 80 gigawatts of wind in permitting. That's just crazy. I mean, that means that everything's ready to go. All we're just waiting for is the rubber stamp to actually, drive this. And then, it's just pretty... It's an indictment on the system, really, that we actually have to, that we've got that much. But hopefully, I guess that when you speak to politicians, I don't know how you're greeted when you bring that message to them. Do you see that politicians are actually looking to do something about it, or they just nod and smile and go, yeah, that's fine?
Well, as always, it's in the middle. So sometimes they say, we understand you. So sometimes they say, we hear you. So that is not the equivalent to we understand you. Yeah. But even if they understand, it's then not the equivalent they want to do something. So that is a little bit the difficulty. Yeah. So sometimes you have to repeat yourself more than once. Sometimes there are other political considerations, even national political considerations, which are the obstacle. There's all kinds of things. In Europe, we unfortunately have 27 countries.
Yep.
So I think it would be easier to understand, or to handle such issues as if there would be one country, in other words, harmonized rules and regulations.
If we just touch upon one more European thing based, the Net Zero Industry Act was passed not too long ago, related to how we get closer to net zero and so on. And I think that's a good example of, if I recall my numbers are correct, that we as Siemens Gamesa are the largest employer, the OEM with the largest industrial footprint in Europe, Is that correct?
Yes, I think we are. We certainly, for instance, in Denmark, have more employees than a big Danish competitor. Yeah. and by and large, yes, I think we have the largest footprint in Europe.
And that's proof that something like that when the EU or other governing bodies make the right decisions, and they pass acts or bills or similar legislation, that they actually absolutely work and are able to provide the stability and the focus and the solid plans that are not just up in the air to ensure employment, to ensure development, and to ensure deployment of renewable energy.
Yeah, they just need to do something. And sometimes with politicians, the issue is around the doing.
Yeah.
Correct. And they need to do so faster.
Yeah, but I mean,
one of our things.
Yeah, I think Joachim's point also around, you know, the China thing was a really interesting take. I hadn't thought about that, you know, about how the Chinese view wind as a critical part of the energy mix and will do everything they can to make sure that that works. And you can see the results in China, what that's meant for the local industry and all that. And I mean, and you just hope that the other regions of the world and other countries of the world would follow suit. Look, but I know, Joachim, we've taken up, you have an appointment to get to and a hard stop at the end of the hour, so we need to wrap this up. But David, do you have anything that caught your attention recently?
I did find it interesting that the Canadian province of Nova Scotia announced plans for up to 5 gigawatts, with the first lease areas expected to be available or at least auctioned off by 2026. That's, I find, extremely ambitious, also extremely encouraging, coming from that part of the world myself, Massachusetts native, not too far from Nova Scotia. And back to you, Stuart.
Well, actually,
more news.
Isn't actually Vineyard sailing out from Nova Scotia like that? I think they're doing their sail out from Nova Scotia. Some of the stuff.
I'll have to ask some of our other industry colleagues at Vineyard Wind.
Sure.
I'm not aware of that.
Yeah. So I guess from my own point of view is that we are looking to have a big, GWEC is looking to have a big APAC offshore wind and green hydrogen summit in August this year. And we just had confirmation. It's going to be in Melbourne, Australia, of course. Where else would we choose to have
where
this
else,
event for the APAC region? But we just had an announcement that it's going to be a global offshore wind alliance moment. So we expect that Australia will lead that, Australia and Japan will lead that. And we've had confirmation that we'll be getting delegations from Vietnam, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, India, that you mentioned also, Joachim, is an important market, Korea, Japan, and the west coast of the US are all going to be heading down to the APAC area. So we need to wrap that up. Good. Anyway, that brings us to the top of the hour. David.
And remember, listeners, you can find us here, the Offshore Wind Podcast, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your favorite shows.
And always, if you like what you've heard, please leave a review. And if you don't like what you heard, David's always open to take complaints. So he loves to hear from you when you're a bit angry. So please direct all that to David. Anyway, look, thank you very much, Joachim Eichholt, CEO for Siemens Gamesa Renewable Energy. Thank you, David. And thank you, listeners. Catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Offshore Wind Podcast, hosted by Stuart Mullen and David Lenti. We hope that you've learned something new today. And if you have any further questions, feel free to send an email to info@gwec.net. The Offshore Wind Podcast is powered by Siemens Gamesa Renewable Energy.